The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And all I can say is on this Thanksgiving holiday weekend is America, we are so thankful for the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling you. Hey, I don't know if I ever told you the story. Freddie Mercury went into a Greek restaurant, and he's finishing his meal, and the waiter came with two plates to break, you know, the Greek tradition. And Freddie Mercury said, "Could I have one more?" The waiter said, "Why?" He said, "I want to break three." Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Oh, that was... I want to break three! Oh, that was really good. Thanks to Duff, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, bass player extraordinaire, and purveyor of ridiculously stupid jokes. Hope Duff and his family had a great Thanksgiving in Seattle, if that's where they are. And I hope you're having a great Thanksgiving wherever you are. And I hope you did have a great Thanksgiving. And remember, it's Black Friday, too. And if you're glued to your computer screen doing a little online shopping, let me make it easy for you. I got a couple things I got to promote here. I got everybody on your list something from my new clothing line, Painmaker Apparel. Go to painmaker.store. T-shirts, hoodies, tracksuits, sweatsuits, all based on my time and tours of Japan. Very, very cool stuff. Go check that out at painmaker.store. And if you're shopping for someone a little extra special, get them a little bit of the bubbly to go along with the new Painmaker threads. You can order that at littlebitofthebubbly.com. That's littlebitofthebubbly.com. And people are just enjoying this. It's really good tasting champagne, too, and it really looks cool. This is the second edition with a very silvery, space-like design, so check that out. And don't forget as well, taking pre-orders for The Complete List of Jericho, the new book that'll be coming out in the spring, featuring every match I've ever had that I've kept personally. That's the truth. Every match I ever had over 30 years. Top 10 lists, memories, favorite arenas, favorite referees, stories from some of the biggest stars in wrestling about me. It's a very, very cool, kind of almost a coffee table book. You can get that at Jericho30.com. And don't forget, if you pre-order it, you get a 90-minute audio podcast, I guess you'd say, from me talking about specific matches that you guys chose. So that's three really cool Jericho Christmases for you. Christmas gifts, painmaker.store for the clothes, littlebitofthebubbly.com for the bubbly, and Jericho 30 for the book. Speaking of books, the new Young Bucks book has arrived. It's called Young Bucks Killing the Business from Backyards to the Big Leagues. You can get that at shopaew.com or wherever you buy books. It's a huge hit. Made it onto the bestseller list already. And I've got Matt and Nick back on the show today, I think for the third or fourth time, to talk about writing the book and share some of the incredible stories from it. They're talking about how they got their dad to build them a wrestling ring in the backyard, how Matt super kicked Nick's front teeth out. It's so bad. And how one errant leg drop off the couch broke their little brother's arm. This is all Matt. He's very stiff with his brothers, apparently. They're talking about their rock bottom days at TNA, how they couldn't even afford a Popeye's chicken sandwich, how the Bullet Club changed their life and made them into huge international successes, how they did that their own way, what inspired them to start focusing on merch, how they got into Hot Topic, They talk Colt Cabana, Pro Wrestling Tees, Being the Elite. Remember a terrible match they had against Brian Danielson and Roderick Strong, and how they became good friends with the late, great Chris Kanyon. It's a great discussion. I love talking to these guys. Matt and Nick Jackson, the Young Bucks, are back on Talk is Jericho right now. Killing the podcast here today. It's the Bucks. So, the new book, Killing the Business, which is a great name from the Young Bucks. Awesome. Matt and Nick, and you guys have been on the show, I think, two times.
Your third. This is number three right here.
Yeah. Wow. We asked permission to make sure we could do this.
Yeah.
This is cool. First of all, I read a bunch of stuff from the book, and we just thought of this yesterday, so I didn't get to read the whole thing. But man, you can totally tell, and this is what a good sign of a good book is, wrestling, whatever. You can tell you guys wrote it.
Yeah.
It's in your voice. You can hear you guys saying this. Just to jump right in, how did you put together this book? Because you've written it like Matt has a chapter,
right?
And then Nick has a chapter, and that you kind of told me about it on and off, but kind of how did you put it all together?
You know, it's funny is the first thing they said to us was like, okay, so we're going to hook you up with a ghostwriter. And I said, whoa, stop you right there. We're not doing a ghostwriter.
Right.
They're like, are you sure? And we were like, yeah, we don't want a ghostwriter. And they couldn't believe it. They were like, are you sure? Because everybody who does these types of books, they usually have someone, especially first-time writers, you have ghostwriters.
Right.
And we kept telling them, we were like, we really want to do this the right way. And our entire career has been done DIY, do it yourself. And it has to be told in our voice. And they're like, okay, I hope you know what you're getting yourselves into.
Yeah, and little did we know what we were getting ourselves into.
Well, and just for, and I we haven't even discussed this, but I can probably guess what people don't know is just how much time it takes to put the other book. Dude. I think I worked it out, my first book, I ended up making like $2.13 an hour, hundreds of hours on this thing.
It's funny when a check finally comes in, you're like, oh yeah, that's right, I got paid for this. Like because it just becomes this burden almost.
Right.
And it's a labor of love.
Yeah.
So immediately we were like, let's write this thing ourselves. Let's do it the right way. And I remember 2 years ago, we started formatting the thing.
And 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, I want to tell this story, this story, this story. And I started putting bullet points up. So I was already kind of trying to create like what I would want the book to look like.
You know what was scary, though? 2 years ago, we know what we're getting ourselves into. We know we're going to set up this company and help create something massive.
Our place was totally full.
So we knew our timing of it was probably the worst timing of our careers to get into something and dive into something so tough. And
right.
So that made
But at the same
hard.
Time, we were like, but we have all this time off, though, so this will be perfect, right?
We thought we had time off.
It ended up being the busiest time of our life, of course, because AEW was in the middle of being, you know, creative.
Well, and that's one of the things when we first started talking about this, it's like talking about EVPs, and there was an idea floated that, Chris, do you want to be EVP? I said, hell no. I don't want to have to do what those guys are doing, because I know all the shit. It's everything.
Yeah, it's every day.
Right?
And so we were like, I don't think we understood that. Like, we didn't understand all the duties that were going to come along with the job.
Mm-hmm.
We just figured like, we've been booking our own angles on the indies anyway. It's pretty easy, right?
That's exactly what we thought.
And so we started writing the book at the same time AEW's opening. And right away, I was like, let's jump into the childhood thing. I figured I would take the first chapter because I'm the older brother. Mm. He wasn't alive yet.
You got 4 years on him.
I got 4 years on him, which people are still, it's funny. We go to the airport all the time and then they're, you know.
You're twins, right?
Yeah, twin brothers.
Yeah. Really?
Twin brothers, like all the time. And we don't think we look anything alike. It's so funny.
You really don't. But people don't know. Like,
if you get to know us.
Exactly. Yeah. But like you said, because I never knew that it was 4 years. It's not a big difference. But when you look through some of these pictures,
sure,
and we'll talk about difference. This. Yeah. Like
that's when you know.
You even wrote one of the pictures. You don't see it until you see like this little guy.
That's right.
And, you know,
there's literally a
towering
picture
over me.
Yeah.
The first time I ever met Nick, there's a picture in the book where he was just born and they have him in the little, like, the little bed as a baby. Oh, and I got my little Hulk Hogan LJN. You know what I mean? And I look like I'm a 4-year-old boy and he's just a baby. So I think people will see that and they'll go, really?
Right.
That's crazy. And then we also obviously have a older sister and a younger brother, Malachi.
Malachi's younger than you guys?
He's the youngest.
Okay, gotcha.
He's the youngest. He's the baby of the family.
Gotcha.
He was actually a wrestler at one point. And he did like one really hard weekend with us. And he's like, okay, I quit. Because we were like local lads. And then the first time he got on a plane, he's just like, I don't know how you guys do this. This is the worst.
It's not for everybody.
It's not. In the beginning, I told Nick, I'd take chapter one. I'll talk about this. I said, you take the second chapter. And we kind of like.
It was like tagging in and out.
Tagging in and out.
Like we're used to.
Which we do.
We built a career off of it. So
might as well write a book that way too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We knew that we wanted to dive kind of deep into that because we never really told anybody about, you know, our childhood and what we dealt with and are having weird religious, I don't want to call them weird, but Christian freak mom and dad.
Right.
You know, it's over, different.
You'll call them a freak, though. Yeah.
Overly religious family, though. Not
They'll never listen to this. Yeah.
No, they will for sure, actually.
Of course they will. Hey, mom and dad.
It's the classic line that Gallo said, I think they're Mormons.
Right.
They got to be something.
Like, you don't know what religion we believe in because we don't ever try to put it down people's throats.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because we hated that as like children.
Right.
We saw it. And we're like, that actually turns you off from being religious.
Sure, sure, sure.
That's how all like our family was, though. You
and they
mean?
Still are.
So, and I haven't read that part of the book. What kind of religion did you grow up in? Like high Christian?
Yeah.
Big time Christianity?
Big time Christian.
We're at church probably three times a week.
Gotcha.
There was really no denomination, though, with because we would go, we could walk into a Baptist church. We could, it was all the same.
Well, that's true Christianity, though.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not the church. It's what you're, who the boss is.
Right.
Exactly.
No matter what denomination.
But we've
right?
been to the crazy churches where they're speaking in tongues and they're making, waving they
flags.
Touch the people and they fall down.
Right.
And like, we've seen it. We've
we
seen
used
it
to
all.
Do that all the time. Yeah.
And that was every Sunday for us. And we would go to churches that were 4 or 5 hours long as kids. And not only that, after that, we would get lunch and everybody's, it's basically Bible study. And then we would go over to, an aunt or uncle's house, Bible study there. And then they would pull out the drums and guitar. And it was
worship.
A marathon.
No kidding.
Yeah. So like that was our Sundays. I remember that, like waking up Monday exhausted. We get home
from
late.
All the church and
right. Man, we've done a lot of church in the last.
You know, it's because when I was a kid, we used to go to. I grew up. My mother was Ukrainian, so it was like Orthodox.
Sure.
And so there's a lot of like, and like you would just sit there for 2 hours where this guy like dressed like the Pope is reciting shit, and you got to recite it back. Then when I came to the States, I started going to church, and that's where the Baptists playing the music, and they're all singing and dancing, and they're showing clips from like movies and stuff. Yes. I was like, this is church.
Yeah, this is more modern and fun.
I would have loved this back when I was a kid.
Yeah, I've been to those style too, because Dana, who I'm married to, she went to one of those more old school type, like
Anglican, Methodist.
And I remember going to a Methodist church for the first time. I was like, this is so weird.
Is
this like Catholic or something? What
it's
is
repeating
this?
Stuff over and over again with the smelly stuff, whatever you call that.
Yes.
The candles that burn.
Right.
Incense.
Incense.
Yeah.
So we dive into that because a lot of people don't really know much about that.
We don't go too crazy religious.
But it's part of
our upbringing.
Yeah.
And now it's like obviously nobody's really going to church because of the whole country's shut down.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We'll still watch it. We'll have our Zoom Sundays and we'll sit there and watch it in the morning. But even before then, our careers got so busy, we haven't been to church regularly.
I haven't been in years. In 10 years.
It's probably impossible.
Amazing to me too, though, and I've known you guys for 3 years or so, worked with you for 3 years, and there is this whole element now in the business. And I came in 90, which was, we don't have to discuss, it was rock star central lunacy.
Right.
It was just kind of in the middle of that. The 90s and 80s were really crazy. But you guys are part of, and Kenny's the same, of no drinking, no drugs, no anything. It's like just good people, which is so rare in the wrestling business. Like, what? And it's real. It's legit for you guys.
I think we came in at the tail end of that.
Right.
It was like early 2000s. That's still in the business.
But you know what? That has to do with our mom and dad, too, though. Our upbringing. Like, they never had it in the house. So I guess, in a way, we were never tempted by any of it. So we never saw any of it.
Yeah.
So, and it was a big thing. Like, I remember sometimes my parents would be like, you can't do that. God would never allow it.
Hell, yeah.
You're going to hell. That was always the fear.
But I'm not even talking about from a parental standpoint. I know tons of guys that came in the business, Cena, Benoit, that never did anything until they got in the business.
Right.
And then they're drinking and doing everything just because you're around all the time. You know?
We were told at a young age, I remember
getting in,
that, a lot of veterans said it. They're like, all right, I see how you are now, but things are going to change.
We'll see.
Yeah. I remember Brian Kendrick would always give us so much crap because he was like, he loved this about us as well. He's like, I love that. He's like, but I hate in 5 years, I know you guys are going to be alcoholics and drug addicts. And luckily it never happened. Maybe he was teasing us, but we would get it a lot where like, at first people didn't understand. They'd be like, hey, come have a drink with us. And we're just like, it's not really our thing. And
we'll still hang out with the guys.
Absolutely. And I think that's why people like us.
Thing,
yeah.
Exactly.
And we won't judge the people who do.
Because I don't care.
Yeah. I don't care either.
I don't mind that.
That's another thing our parents taught us, though. Don't be judgmental to others. And
yes,
we've carried that along the way.
I try never to be judgmental, generalize. I hate all of that. People are people.
The business too. There's the real all gypsies, tramps, and thieves in one way or another. So you can't ever judge anybody for what they're doing here. Right.
Correct.
You know, but it's interesting too because, like you said, back in the day, it was like you got to drink with the boys, and even Lance Storm used to take major heat because he never drank, never did anything.
Wow, okay.
Finally, he's like, dude, just hold this bottle in your hand.
Right.
It can be the same one all night long. No one's going to care because back then, it's like if you didn't go out, you're like a stooge or you wouldn't be trusted.
I can see that.
And all that's gone, but you guys still hang. Like, times Nick is up till 6 a.m. sometimes. Yeah. You know? And so that's – it's just part of the camaraderie of being being part of the gang.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed – also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So as we get our rundown sheets, we're officials here. So you're talking about putting together the book and how did you write it? Because you mentioned you had all this time off, but you're super busy. Right.
So we did it all on our phones.
Wow. That's what's crazy. Yeah,
that is crazy.
It would be in between. I don't think that was ever the plan. Like, hey, we're gonna do this all on our phones. I just started writing one night on my phone and my notepad while I was in bed. I was like, because I just wanted to take a crack at it. And I was like, man, this is going really well. This is just the best way. I just know phones. I'm on my phone more than I'm ever on a computer these days.
Right.
And it's always there. So
we have those long flights from California to wherever we're going. So we found that was probably the easiest time to focus on the book.
I remember being at the bus stop waiting for my daughter Courtney to get, you know, to come. And I would pull
from
up my
school.
Phone from school and I would start writing the thing. And my neighbor would come by. He's like, hey, what are you doing there? You look like you're, you know, pretty focused on something. So I'm just writing I'm writing my book. He's just like, what? But it was literally in between any time we could do something. When we weren't planning something for AEW. Or when we were at home, it was just book. And it was like almost like a burden because anytime I was like, oh my God, I got a free hour. Nope, I can't go enjoy myself. Yep. I can't. I haven't watched a show in so long. I haven't been able to enjoy anything because it was always like, I've got the book. It was always in the back of my mind. And it wasn't just writing the book. It was fact checking. It was talking to family and making sure the dates lined up.
Looking for pictures.
It was blowing the dust off of old photo albums and going, there's a photo. It was going to cage match and seeing our matches and going, I thought that match was in 2004.
We didn't write our dates down like you did. So so it was a lot of research.
So much research.
I wish we did. You know?
But you know what's funny though? Like I wrote my first book in 2007 about the first 30 years of my life, but the first 10 years of my career.
Right.
And none of that stuff was documented because it was all Mexico and Japan and Indies. So I couldn't go back and check. So I bet you 50% of that is wrong, but it's what I remember.
Sure.
Now, and I know this from the new book I'm working on with all the matches, like Marvez will call me and say, I read in Cage Match at this time. Like, are you serious? Like, I worked with The Rock in Madison Square Garden in 1990. I didn't. He goes, you did. How did I not remember that? But that's it's all there for you to see in the computer, on the internet.
It helps.
Thank God for the computer, man. Like, it saved us. But like going back to like even the photos, like when the publisher's like, you need a photo. What'd they tell us? It was like, you need a photo or two to represent each chapter in the book, right?
Right.
Some of these are impossible. How am I going to do that? And I look back, I'm like, some of the photos I have like from old digital cameras, they're not big enough.
Yeah, it wouldn't work.
So they wouldn't work. Right. Or like, I had to like track down old photographers. I had to do so much homework.
Fans from the audience.
Sometimes I would have fan photos and I was like, this is a great photo of the original story of the Elite forming, but it was a fan photo. They're like, okay, can you get permission from the fan? I'm like, how am I going to go back in time to Tokyo at the Corken Hall in 2015 or whatever it was? And so it's like I couldn't use so many of the photos I wanted in the book. It's like finding the photos it took me 6 months. Mm. And then when I finally had it, I'm like, oh, my God, that was harder than writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I have newfound respect for anybody who's ever done this.
Oh, for sure.
Because it was such a project.
Especially if you're doing it the way you guys are doing it, because you want it to be right. So you are in charge of everything.
You have to be.
You know,
if you want your story told right, you have to tell it yourself.
Yeah.
The other thing is, how do you find an ending? Because everyone, it's like, are people going to be disappointed with the ending? Do they want to know more about this thing? But it's like, I don't know when it happened. It was like, what, we were like halfway writing it, and I think I came up with the idea for the finish.
Yeah, and I knew right away, all right, that's
and it felt right. Yep. Like, but even that we struggled with.
What is the finish of the book?
The finish, I'll be spoiling it here, it's okay. We get to the point where AEW is going to be finally announced.
Right.
Because we figured that could be a whole other book in itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 2 years here already is a
book. I felt like it's kind of a cliffhanger to, maybe they will.
And that's the way to do it.
Right.
Like I said, I'm 5 books in. You guys could easily do another one just talking about all your experiences at AEW.
Right. Yep. We get really heavy into like the struggles we had too as independent wrestlers, because we were talking about this earlier in a different interview where like we broke into the 2000s. There was like, it was the end of the Attitude Era.
Yeah.
There's no money in independent wrestling.
Right?
No.
Because wrestling was kind of on
the
ground.
Especially in California.
Right.
Like California, a lot of people don't realize it, but at the time there was only one big independent show there, and it was called Pro Wrestling Guerrilla.
Right.
And it was hard just to get to that.
Yeah, it was the one chapter I read said you guys couldn't get booked there. Super Dragon wouldn't listen.
It was like the ever eluding PWG, and they paid you $50. So it wasn't like find gold.
Everyone watched it.
Yes.
Like from the East Coast, people watched it. The promoters watched it. The wrestlers watched it.
It's a modern day ECW. I never made more than $250 for a show in ECW. Yep,
that's it.
But if you were on ECW, you were
you're
somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was our first break, was getting there, because that's what it made us explode. And we had a Japanese talent guy, talent relations from Dragon Gate, at the show, saw us. It was our second show there.
It might have been like our second show. Or third show there,
so it shows you it was fast. Two shows, and we got to Japan from that. Yeah. So we knew we had to get
to that.
But
you know what's funny is even before then, though, we started backyard wrestling way before then when I was 16. So we were already
literally
in my backyard. Yeah. Our dad built this ring because we were, you know, wrestling out on the streets and wrestling at our neighbors' houses, or like we talk about in the book where like there was this furniture store and we set up like camp out back where they had old soggy mattresses and we would just wrestle in there. So they had an old truck that had spider webs around the wheels because it hadn't moved in a while, and we'd jump off the top of that and anywhere to wrestle.
Because at that point our parents were like, you guys can't do this in our backyard anymore. It's too dangerous. So we just found other places.
Yes, which was way more dangerous.
But we didn't tell them.
So then that's when they were like, we were at this place called Soup Plantation. It was like this restaurant.
It's a little buffet style.
That's now since gone out of business. But I remember my dad, he's called for a family meeting, and he's like, you guys just won't stop wrestling, will you? Like he's like, if you're not going to stop, I guess I just have to build you a ring. And we're like, really?
Was he like a carpenter type guy?
He did it all. He's a general contractor, so he built homes and room additions.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
And but at the time, I mean, this is when I'm 16 years old and I'm 35 now, so this is close to 20 years ago. There wasn't really, like, you couldn't just Google how to build a wrestling ring. You know what I mean?
He watched enough wrestling, though, to know how to build one. And
but you never know what's underneath, though. That's the big thing.
That was the struggle.
That's
that
we struggled with at first.
So we just used carpet padding. We had no clue what else use.
But even then, the framing. Because he's like, what's the frame? Is there a spring in the
middle?
He's
like, how does it bounce?
Right. Yeah. Is it trampolini? Right. You never know for sure.
Yeah.
Right?
So like, he came up with a pretty good concept because the ring was really soft. And it was a good ring. Like, the ropes are a little loose. But like, for our first ring, because we ended up having several.
Yeah.
The first one was really good.
Once we got a hang of it, was actually like a pro ring.
Right.
You must have been the most popular kids in school.
Oh,
their own wrestling ring, yeah.
Dude, everyone in the neighborhood, they would stop by. They knew we were the crazy.
I get messages to this day from fans saying, hey, I used to watch you guys in your backyard in Rancho Cucamonga. I'm so proud of you.
Would you put it online or something? Or how
we would do that.
That was like in the beginning of the internet kind of getting hot.
We had egos as backyard wrestlers. I remember do you remember the big tape they had? It was like, what was it called? King of Backyard Wrestling, or they wanted to have our company on it. Our company.
No,
it was called
Best of Backyard Wrestling.
That's what it was. Yeah. And they asked us to put our clips in, and we're
what's your company called?
BYWA, Backyard Wrestling Association.
And my name, I was Mr. BYWA.
And we said, listen, we don't want to be on your VHS. We're too big for that.
Yeah, because like they were like the movement back then was like they were the hardcore wrestlers who did the fluorescent light tubes and the thumbtacks. And we were like, we looked down on that. Well, that's dirty wrestling.
Yeah, we do the spots.
Right. Like we were into like doing RVD and Jerry Lynn's high spots. Right. Like we wanted to wrestle and Savage and Steamboat. Like we tried to recreate those.
You know what's funny though is it goes through generations, because my dad was not a carpenter, but we would put all the couch cushions on the floor.
Oh yeah.
And my friend and I knew the whole Savage Steamboat match.
That's great.
And we would reenact it, and we could play both roles.
Yep.
So I remember being a kid doing. Wow. We call them two counts. There was like 18-2 counts in the match. That's false finishes.
Yep.
But same thing. It's just yep,
that's crazy.
As generations move.
Matt and I did that exactly, but with the RVD Jerry Lynn match.
Oh, wow.
Literally spot for spot.
But you know what? Even before then in the living room, I would put on the Coliseum Home Videos because we would go to Blockbuster and we would rent them all like multiple times over. And we would watch the Rockers. And we would, you know, we would be throwing super kicks and we would be Malachi. One time I did a leg drop off the couch and I broke his arm.
Yeah.
And he heard a crack. It's like, oh my God, did something happen? And like, we all kayfabed our parents.
Yeah.
Poor Malachi's going to school for 2 weeks with a broken arm until he finally's like, Mom, my arm really hurts.
Did we ever tell you this?
He took him and got an x-ray.
Did we ever tell you the story? I was 11. You were 15. Yeah. We were in Las Vegas, and he super kicked my front teeth out.
No way.
Yeah.
With just, a super kick, of
we
course.
We had a game where
our favorite move later on that would help make us a lot of money.
We would surprise each other by super kicking each other when we least expected, and you had to sell the move. You know what I mean? Like, Nick would turn a corner. I'm like, hey, Nick, surprise, super kick. Boom. So
I was brushing my hair one day. I think we were in Las Vegas.
We were in a Las Vegas hotel. Our parents were down playing slots.
I turn around. He goes, surprise. I have the brush right in front of my mouth. Super kicks me right in the teeth. I look. I go, oh, my God, Matt.
Yeah.
My front teeth are out. I start bawling
my eyes. He looks at me and he has that Mick Foley smile. And I start panicking. I'm like, holy crap. So I was like, I have to call my parents. So like they probably had a cell phone by then. I somehow got a hold, or did we have to wait? I don't remember.
Maybe a pager.
But we finally told them you have to get here. And they're like, what happened? We're like, everyone's okay. Just come. We didn't want to tell them what happened.
To this day, they think that's not the true story about how you broke my teeth.
They think we're covering up.
Yeah, why would you lie about that? Right. You tripped and fell into the desk or something.
Yeah.
So they show up. They grab a glass of milk. They put the teeth in, thinking they could save these teeth or something.
In milk? What does that have to do with anything? It's got calcium in it.
They're looking up Dennis in Vegas. They're trying to get him in. They're thinking they could save it. They couldn't save them. They had to, so these teeth that Nick have are fake.
Yeah.
These veneer or whatever, right? Is that what they're called?
Wow.
They redid all four top ones because one of them was not grown in all the way anyway. So they're like, let's just cap them all.
This poor kid. They gave him back then. He had to wear a mold, or it looked like he had bubble gum in his mouth.
Yeah, back in the day, they didn't know how to do it.
And
they
made him wear this mold for a week or two,
just to get the molding done for the fake.
And he had to go to. My parents made him go to school with this mold. He was so. Remember you told me I wouldn't open my mouth for 2 weeks.
I was so embarrassed. Yeah. They're like, "What is wrong with your mouth, Nick?" I'm like, "Nothing."
Must have hated your brother. You son of a bitch.
So that's why wrestling was so it was banned for a while in our house, and that's when my dad was like, "We're gonna build you this ring." We were so surprised because I'd broken my brother's arm. I shattered his teeth.
You're stiff, man. You're the stiff one in the family.
So when he's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna build you a ring," we're like, "Really? Holy crap!" Looking back now, though, I think we lived in Southern California, family of six. My mom didn't work. My dad did work, but he was an independent contractor. And there's not a lot of money. You never know when your next gig is. It's a lot like wrestling.
And by the way, he's a legit independent contractor, not a wrestling contractor version. Right.
So
right.
It's already tough to live in California, let alone where we do in SoCal with a family of six.
And Rancho Cucamonga is not LA. It's in the middle of the fields. Yeah.
At the time, it was really a small city. Now, since it's kind of blown up, it's kind of rather large now. But we didn't have a lot of money. So I think my parents realized we're not going to be able to send our kids to a major university or anything. And I think they saw that we were serious about this wrestling thing.
This is what you want to do.
And I think this was their way of saying, you know what? We could do this for them, though. Mm. And maybe it could pay off for them. And it's so funny because now you look back at the full story and you're like, God, that really paid off.
Yeah.
And my dad is so proud that he did it.
Yeah.
Because so many people probably – can you imagine? Oh, I'm going to build my son a wrestling ring.
Right.
People probably thought he was crazy.
I remember our grandparents saying that. What are you – thinking. Yeah.
How dangerous is that? Insurance reasons, all that stuff, right?
And all the neighborhood kids are there too. But you know what? To our credit, we were responsible. We never did. Once we had the ring, we didn't do anything stupid. We wanted to be pro wrestlers.
Right.
So we took it serious. We looked down, like I was saying, on the guys that were using the barbed wire and all this stuff. We're like, we don't want to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
We want to do this as a career. Here I am, 16, he's 12, and we were already kind of making that decision.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Well,
talk about the one show that you had in the Olympic in LA. It was sold out, and Nick lies that he's 18, but he's only 15. And like, that's amazing to me that you were not just allowed to, but that you were wrestling that young in front of that many people. That's crazy.
Oh, it blew my mind.
Yeah.
I remember signing that waiver. All right, I'm going to pretend I'm 18, Matt. But like, man, that was crazy because before that, we had done shows for $5.
Yeah, and no crowd.
No crowd at all. Yeah. Well, 200 people max, maybe. So going from 200 people to 8,000, I think it was.
That was the only thing.
It blew my mind.
But you know what? Yeah. Back then, the only thing that drew was if you brought in the Lucha
Libre
guys, the big popular ones.
For the Mexican Spanish people. Yeah.
Nobody else
Latino crowd, right?
Yeah. Blue Demon, I think, was on the card. Like Conan was massive. El Santo. Like the big names drew that house.
Yeah.
But just to get that experience at that young age, man, it blew my mind. It felt like we were in a dream. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't real. All these lights on me. I'm 15, you know?
That was the day that we got named the Young Bucks.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, tell that very day.
Yeah, they did. So
you were Mr. High
Level. I was Mr. Instant Replay. I wore red.
I was Slick Nick.
Nick wore blue.
Original.
Yeah. And for whatever reason, it never even really crossed our minds, like, hey, should we be attacked? And we just always wanted to be singles wrestlers.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what it was. At that time, at least.
You were a singles guy, you know what I mean? We looked up to you. Sean was, at the time, a singles guy. So we thought, we could be singles
Not
wrestlers.
To mention, too, it's your little brother.
Yes.
You
want
to be a tag team with your little brother.
Maybe that's
right.
It.
Maybe so that's
once again, 19 and 15, that might as well be 60 and 20.
Correct.
Right? It's a whole big difference. Universe. Right. Yeah.
But it's so funny because at the same time, we were still heavily influenced by like the Hardys and the Rockers.
That, too, for sure.
But you know what? I was talking to Matt about this, Matt Hardy, the other day about this. Like, the Hardy Boys were the hottest thing in the world at that point. And it was almost uncool for guys like us to like the Hardys because they were all the girls like the Hardys.
Right,
and they were,
guys,
you know, they're girly boys. They're too handsome. Like, I had to, like, I was a closet Hardy Boy fan. And like, I maybe in the back of my mind, like, I really wanted to be a team with Nick, but like, I didn't want to be like the Hardys. Like, I can't be like them. They're too cool. They're too cool for school. I thought I was too cool for school almost if I liked them. You know what I mean? But now looking back, I'm like, God, why couldn't I just admit I loved you guys?
Well, not to mention there's so many similarities. I mean, you guys are so similar. The first time we ever met at that studio in Century City, I was like, you guys are the fucking Hardy Boys, man.
Same story.
Almost same look, same age difference, you know?
Well,
it really is.
Easier than the other.
But yeah, so we get to this show where we were just so happy that we even got booked because at the time we're making $25 a shot. And the guy in charge, Joey Gass, is like, I'm going to pay you guys $75 each. And we're like, holy crap, $75? Yeah. Like, we can make a living doing this if this is how we got paid, right?
Right.
So he brings us in, and he had sent us at an indie show. And we were Mr. Instant Replay, and we were Slick Nick. Something's going on in this other office.
Filming probably something for your show.
Probably for BT. So we get booked, and we go to the card, and we're like looking everywhere for our names.
We were disappointed. We're not on the card.
Where's Mr. Instant Replay and Slick Nick on the card? It's not on the card. And all of a sudden, we asked Joey, like, hey, man, like, you know, we're here. We're here to wrestle. And he's like, yeah, you're on the card right there against us. I go, excuse me? It's like, I look on the thing, and it's Joey and his partner at the time, Mongo, and it says versus Matt and Nick, the Young Bucks. And I go, why are you calling us Matt and Nick, the Young Bucks? He's like, dude, I'm going to be really honest with you. Like I couldn't remember your guys' names. And like when we kept going back to the match and we were talking about it, we just kept referring to you guys as Matt Nick, those Young Bucks. So that's just going to be your name today, okay? And we were like, our hearts just sunk. We're like, that's great. And as soon as he walked away, we're like, that is the worst. We're like in panic mode. Right. We can't be Matt and Nick, the Young Bucks. That's the worst thing ever. We weren't yet the Jacksons. We were Matt and Nick, the Young Bucks. So we go out there, and it's a largely Hispanic crowd. They're all blowing the blowhorns, and it's crazy, and it's like feels like we're in a movie. We'd never wrestled in front of more than 200 people.
Right.
So it's like everything looks weird. I think they had pyro that night, so there's like smoke everywhere. It looks like you're in a dream for us.
Right.
We hear the music. That
we're
song
not gonna take it.
My Twisted Sister.
No, we ain't gonna take it.
Like the whitest white boy music ever.
Why that song?
I don't know.
They boo the hell out
They're
of us.
They're booing us. They're saying every homophobic slur in the world because back then it was okay to say these
right,
words.
Right, right,
but at the same time, it doesn't feel good. We're just like, they're throwing batteries at us. And we're just like, we're supposed to be the baby faces. So we're like, oh my God, this is terrifying. So immediately these other guys come out and like, they're like rock stars. Yep. All their friends and family are there, and they're Mexican guys, so like the fans are already behind them, and they're supposed to be the heels. And we're just like, we're doomed. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So we end up having a really competitive match, though. And I think the crowd, it took maybe 5-6 minutes for them to finally buy into us because we were good. We were doing high-flying things, and they respected it. By the end, we were getting towards the finish. We're like, I think one of them had me in like a helicopter spin on his shoulders, and the other came with a missile dropkick off the top. And I remember just being up there going, oh, as long as I could land this finish, we're done. We're out of here. Because you guys were bringing it in this match. I was like,
never felt that before.
Never right? Felt stiff.
Yeah.
Like men hitting me. Yep. Men hitting
me. Yeah.
We were working with boys on the indies. These guys were big, strong men.
Yeah, it was a big difference.
So we get to the end, and they spin me, and he drop kicks the hell out of me, and I just fall over. I'm like, I survived my first real match, basically. And they covered me, and we were so proud. And we get to the back, and we have these little envelopes right by our bags. We're like, oh, my God, there's the $75. We open it up, and it's not $75. It's a crisp $100 bill.
Ah, bonus.
And Nick and I look at each other like, oh, my God.
We've made it.
We made it. $100? And not only that, like a week, 2 weeks later, we're still like, we don't want to be the Young Bucks. It's a terrible name. But everyone that books us, we look on the flyers, because back then that's how we had flyers and posters.
We were on the big show as the Young Bucks.
We were on everybody booked
everybody
us.
Everybody saw you.
Yeah, Nick.
That was probably our first mini break, in California.
That's, you know, we have to look back and fact check. I don't remember, 2004 or 5.
Yeah, probably.
And that was it. We were the Young Bucks, and there was no changing that at that point.
So we finally said, you know what, let's get matching gear, and let's try to make this work,
let's go with it, yeah.
But we couldn't afford anything, so we went and got these, like, yellow, like, spandex, the ugliest yellow. I don't know, why did we choose yellow? Like,
yeah, we bought some just random generic tights from
Dick's, like, Dick's Sporting Goods. Yeah.
And then we went to an indoor swap meet, and we were like, hey, we saw this airbrush guy. We're like, can you airbrush Young Bucks on here with, like, a dollar sign so we can do a play on words and stuff? And the guy's like, sure, and he did that. And, like, we thought we looked so cool. Looking back now, it's like, what were we thinking?
Yeah, but we had no money.
We had we ordered these offering side.
Yeah,
boxing boots, because we couldn't afford wrestling boots. And, like, these were on sale. They're, like, $25 or something. So we're wearing these white, ugly, like, cloth boxing boots with these yellow, like, you can see through them. You can see our underwear.
You know what I just figured out? Yeah. What a brain surgeon I am.
Yeah.
I always thought Young Bucks like a deer, like a buck, like a thing. And I, when you guys shoot the money, I was like, oh, like the money, whatever. I just got it now. Young Bucks. Dollars. That's bucks. Like, what a... What an idiot I am. That's right. You know, Jeez Louise, I just got that right now.
How funny.
We do a play on both of them, though. We do the deer thing, too. But yeah,
we've had shirts with the deer. We've done all those.
The dollar thing, it's been our thing since, like, day one.
Gotcha.
That's funny that you just got that.
Just right now, because you guys have been shooting dollar bills out for the last, you know, year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's our thing.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
And don't forget, you got until Saturday the 30th, which is tomorrow if you listen to this on Friday, to check out Capturing Judas, which is the live stream we did that Midwest Beatdown Magazine said was the best live stream they've seen, better than Metallica's, which is always cool to hear. We always try. Go to fozzy.veeps.com. I think it's $10 or $15 to watch the show, and you get a 90-minute Fozzy concert with stories from the road that we filmed in a studio in Atlanta with all social distance precautions taken. And we kick it off with a 30-minute documentary we did called Fozzy Across America, where we did 3 shows in 3 different time zones in 1 day when the Judas record came out. So you get all that for $10, I believe it is. Fozzy.veeps.com. Check it out if you want something fun to do, and if you want to see it, if you missed it somehow, you can watch it for another couple days, and then it'll be gone forever. So Fozzy.veeps.com, CapturingJudas.com, and come be a part of the Fozzy madness. There's lots of, like I said, just reading the stuff that I've read. There's a couple stories that stood out for me. And one, I just did a podcast, which will be out soon, about Chris Kanyon. I did it with Raphael. Do you know Raphael was really good friends with him?
Oh, really?
And DDP and Hurricane Helms.
Oh, cool.
You have a lot to say about Chris.
Yeah.
Both, we talk about his good side, his bad side, everything.
Right.
I didn't realize, you know, you never realize who's influencing who, but he was a big influence on you.
You know, it's crazy. Yeah. That same company where we were doing 6,000 to 8,000 people, that's where we met him.
They brought Chris.
They started running on a monthly basis, so they started bringing in, like, former WCW guys, and that was our first time meeting him. Was maybe that second one.
Maybe the second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to go in?
They brought Chris in, and we were like, this was the first guy, like a star that we met, that we saw on TV.
Right.
Like, I think
we weren't huge Lucha Libre fans, right. So we didn't understand the history that El
Although
Santo and these.
We did pop huge when they brought Conan.
Yeah,
we're
we
like,
did.
Oh my God, the wolf back.
But we did, just didn't realize.
WCW, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
But then we saw Canyon, and Canyon like immediately took a liking to us. And he approached us, and we were like, why is this guy talking to us? This is. And
we're
was
just,
so nice.
We're just these jobbers, you know?
And at this point, our little backyard company had become like an independent, and we were renting out buildings and selling tickets and stuff.
What's it called? High.
It was called High Risk Wrestling.
High Risk Wrestling, yeah.
And it was mostly our backyard friends who had gone to training, or Nick and I had trained them or whatever, and then a mixture of like local SoCal
guys. One of them
guys.
Is Brandon Cutler.
One of them was Brandon Cutler and his brother Dustin and Malachi.
Yep.
So Chris comes up to us. He's just like, hey, you know, I'm Chris Kenyon. You're like, yeah, no duh. We're like, holy crap, he's talking to us, you know. And he's like, he wanted to know a little bit about us. And we actually told him, we're like, we actually run a company like 3 hours from here. Like, would you ever like want to like, you know, do a show for us?
Like, we thought it was a long shot.
Yeah. And then immediately he's like, yeah, bro, that'd be great. And we're like, what? He's like, yeah, let's trade contacts and I'll be in contact and we'll set it up. He's like, maybe you can piggyback off the next time these guys bring me in and I can just come in. And we're like, oh my God, this is amazing. We need a Canyon.
And you know what's crazy? That first show we brought him in, we saw a massive difference between like, we were drawing maybe 100.
Yeah.
Wow, so that drew for you guys.
He drew us our biggest crowd at the time. It was like 450, I want to say.
It was a good house,
and we couldn't believe it. We're all, wow, this does work.
Yeah.
And he was so nice. And like, I remember we would do like, before the shows, we would do like little training sessions. He got in there and did a seminar for all of us. We're like, this guy's the greatest. Mm. And we took a liking to him to the point where like, we're talking to this guy, would you say like every day?
Yeah. He was giving us advice on how to make it and just telling us his whole story. And we were blown away. It was crazy.
And then like, we got to know him a little bit. And I don't know. I don't want to say it got weird. But like,
well, so we talked with Chris. Chris was gay in a time just towards the end of when it wasn't, I shouldn't even say cool, but when, who gives a shit? We knew he was gay in the 90s.
Right.
But he would never say it. He was really withdrawn with that.
Mm-hmm.
And when he finally started telling, hey, I'm gay, we're like, and?
Right.
Like, yeah, so?
See, you guys we're naive kids. We didn't know.
Gotcha.
And we're just like, oh, this guy's really great and he wants to help us in the wrestling business, right? So finally, one day, he calls me, and he's like, listen, bro, I have something to tell you. And I'm like, okay, what's up, Chris? You got more advice on tag wrestling? You know, I don't know. And he's like, listen, like, I don't want to sound weird. He's like, but the moment I saw you at the show, he's like, I gravitated towards you because I'm kind of attracted to you. And right away, I'm like, holy crap, right. Where's this going? He's like, listen, I hope this doesn't change things, but bro, I'm gay. And I was like,
guy.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay. And like, again, like I have so many, I have a gay uncle, I have a gay aunt, I have so many gay friends, even at the time, at that age, like I knew so many homosexual people. It didn't bother me. I was like, okay. But the thing that bothered me was I was thinking, wait a minute. So were you never really interested in like working with us? Were you hitting on me? You know what I mean? And then he's like, that's the first reason why I did. He's like, but now we're friends, man. And he's like, but I just want to ask you if you're gay too, because I just feel like there's an attraction here. And I had to tell him, and I hit a line that I don't know if I used in the book. I don't remember.
You used the book.
Did I? Yeah. I said, Chris, I hate to break to you, man, but I'm exclusive to vagina to try to pop him. Yeah. And I think he did pop, but at the same time, I think he was kind of like let down because he was hoping I was so obsessed with wrestling. I just didn't talk about girls. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't interested yet.
Right.
Like I believe that Dana and I were going through a breakup at the time or something. So she wasn't really around.
Yeah, in the book, it said that you were not even interested in girls. At
yeah.
That point.
Yeah. And like, I think he might've been let down, but at the same time, he's like, that doesn't change anything, man. We're friends. I still want to come in. Cause we brought him in a couple more times, I think.
Yeah.
And he came in, and then I started like,
He was getting a lot more depressed.
He was getting sad.
We could tell.
Yeah.
And
he would always tell us to pray for him.
Yeah.
And we did, but we were like, it was getting like more and more like
very bipolar.
Until it finally came down to, I'm just a kid at the time, and he calls me one day, and I'm about to hop in the shower, and he calls me, and he's hysterically crying, and I'm just like, what's wrong, man? And I can't even get a word in. And he's like, finally, he's just like, I'm thinking about killing myself. I'm thinking about killing myself right now. And I'm just like, Chris, dude, relax. I'm like, what do I say to this guy?
Right.
I don't. I'm a child.
Yeah.
And he's like, just pray for me right now, man. Pray for me. He's like, I don't even know if I believe, but pray for me. And so I sit there and I'm praying with him. And like the whole bathroom's filling up with steam. And I'm just thinking, like, I'm almost in shock a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think I talk him down, and we get off the phone, and I'm just like, that was the most intense thing that's probably ever happened to me.
Right.
And I'm like, this is getting kind of heavy now, this relationship with this guy. And after that, we kind of lost touch a little bit. Like, I think we saw him maybe another time. We could see he was kind of like falling apart a little bit. Like, he showed up at a WWE show and tried to like do some type of weird like invasion.
He showed up
things,
in the front row,
right?
And he was driving around in the van. Like, yeah.
It just seemed like he was kind of losing. So I would check in with him and see if he's okay. But I could just tell something was up.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand. Again, I was just a kid. I didn't know what being manic depressive meant. I had no clue. I had no idea what that meant. Because he would tell me that, and it would brush right off me. I'm like, okay, what is that? You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
And he struggled with it. And we tried to be there with him, but it got to the point where, like, every time we talked to him, it was so unsettling and strange. That I don't know. It was like
we lost contact.
We lost contact with him, and that was it. And then I remember
the day we found out what happened.
I was heartbroken.
Remember, we were on the road. We couldn't believe it.
Dustin called me.
That's right.
Dustin Cutler. He called me. He's like, did you hear? And I'm like, what? And he told me, and I was just devastated.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, and even now, like, I think back.
And even at that young age, we're like, could we have helped?
Of course you think, like, that.
You always think that.
Yeah.
Brian Cage was a great friend of Chris. Yeah, also.
Yep.
And
Brian.
Yeah, they were
still
using buddies, man. Yeah. So even I see Cage, I'm always reminded, you know, he does the Who Betta thing. Yeah, like, I think about Chris a lot.
He was just a troubled soul, you know?
He was.
Just caught in a strange time.
He was so good, too, man. People don't realize.
Very funny.
Yeah, very funny.
Great guy.
He taught us a lot, too. A lot of the stuff in the rings, too. I use some of these weird mannerisms, these ideas he gave me. I still think about him a lot. Yep. So
he always called me A.O. Jericho. Always opinionated.
A.O. Jericho.
Yeah. Another story, like I said, of the ones that I read that seemed like another kind of eye-opening experience to you that almost seems like it went off the rails a bit is your match that you had with Bryan Danielson and Roderick Strong.
Oh, yeah.
It seemed like it was kind of went awry. Tell what happened on that.
Yeah. It's funny, Matt has yet to watch that back because he has such bad memories of it. That was a DDT tournament for PWG, which meant we had to wrestle three times in one night. And for PWG, those matches were so hard on the body.
Wow.
And this was the finals. And I believe it was the second match that we had. We were supposed to be the baby faces, but for whatever reason, the crowd turned on us completely.
In match two. You know what it was? We were wrestling Kenny and Chuck Taylor, the men of low moral fiber. And they were just these.
What was their name?
Yeah. they were like, it was like their first time teaming. And they were two singles guys, but they were two popular hot acts. And people just wanted them to win. And I think at this point, we're just the white meat, fist pumping, come on baby guys. That
they were over that.
They'd seen the act for
come on baby, that'll never get over.
And I think they were just like, you know what? We've seen this act. These guys are just good guys. They don't have any depth to their character. Mm-hmm. So they turned on us. And when we beat those guys in the second round, the whole place booed us out of the building. And Brian and Roderick were in the finals with us, and it was a problem because they saw us as the baby still. And they were like, listen, we got to get the crowd to sympathize for you guys again. And the way we're going to do it, this was Brian's suggestion, we're just going to have to beat the hell out of you. And we were like, we agreed because we're like, yeah, you're probably right. That's cool. Let's do that. But we had no idea what we just agreed to. You know what I mean? So we go out there, and I don't think they knew either how bad it was going to get. They go out there, and they're just the ultimate baby faces, and we're getting booed out of the building no matter what. And we don't know what we're doing.
They would hit us harder, and it would get a bigger reaction each time.
The more they hit us, or the more they slammed us, the more they kicked us, the crowd got louder and louder and louder. And if we fought back, they booed.
Oh, wow.
So they're thinking, like, well, we just got to hit them harder. We got to hit them more. And they cheered more and more and more. And the idea just backfired. It wouldn't work. And instead of like just trying something new or just going with the flow, they just continued beating us. Mm. And it got to the point where it felt like it was like we were in a real fight, where I remember even like Roderick would run down the apron when I wasn't even the legal guy, and he'd pull me down and throw me into the chairs. And like, if we're fighting out in the seats, and like at one point the Cutlers were there, and they thought they were going to have to. They told me this later.
That was a shoot.
Yeah. They thought they were going to have to come down and help us because they thought we were getting
our poor wives were in the crowd.
Yeah.
And they were crying their eyes out because they knew they've seen enough wrestling to know, man, these guys are literally getting beat up.
Yeah. It was rough. At one point, I remember Nick was getting the elbows from Brian, and Nick was just like after the 20th one or whatever, you're like,
that's right.
Enough.
I said, stop. But he kept
and
going.
We were never the wussy types of guys. We took a beating. Like, I took a beating in wrestling school. Like, I would show up, like, to the point where my mom and dad were like, we're going to call the cops for assault and battery. You have a black eye again, busted lip. Because like Nick said, we were kind of the arrogant backyard wrestler because they were trying to teach us a little humility.
Right.
So like we were used to getting our asses beat. But this was next level. Mm. This was like nothing I'd ever even – I don't think I've ever seen since. And like Nick said, I haven't even watched the tape back because I'm – I don't know. It's weird. It's like I feel like I've seen a clip before and I get kind of angry again. Mm. And it's like why would I want to relive that? And Roderick came up to us right afterward and he apologized for the whole thing.
Because like, I don't know what happened out there.
And I know Brian felt bad about it too. But it's like I'm not even upset with him anymore about it. Like why would I – at this point, like I'm still buddies with these guys, but like I still look back at that and it was a learning lesson for me because I don't think I'll ever do that to anybody because I don't want to ever make a younger talent feel the way that I felt that night and continue to kind of feel, you know,
you don't
what I mean?
Like ever feeling taken advantage yes. of, and that's how we felt right. after
yeah. Yeah. yeah when you yeah. trust each other with your bodies.
And it's funny because it's two of the best wrestlers I know, two of yeah. my buddies that
which
did
is
it.
So surprising to yeah. me, especially because I don't know Roderick at all. But working with Brian, not that I've ever had the great match that we probably could have had, but it surprises me they just wouldn't have gone with the flow and just turned heel.
You know?
Yeah. Or turn babyface.
You're right. Like, I don't know. Like, I remember Super Dragon at the time because he was the promoter. He was kind of on their side too, though, because he saw us as a babyface act too.
Yeah, I remember after the second match, we got back and we went up to him and said, we got to be the heels yeah. now.
So it wasn't really just their fault, because I think he was also in their ear going,
I gotcha.
Yeah. No, they're my babies. Yeah. We were like their top baby face tag team. So I think there's a lot of different people. It was yeah. just a weird thing. I think now in retrospect, all of us would have made a different decision that night.
For sure.
And then the thing I regret is hitting back. I probably should have just taken it. And then like it would have been easier on me. But like I think maybe they thought like, oh, okay, these guys are into it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. no, I really
I
wasn't.
That. Yeah,
it's like
that.
Maybe we made the mistake of doing that and just fighting back.
It's the lessons that you learn when yeah. you're coming through the business.
Absolutely.
You know, we've all had those moments.
Yeah.
Right. You know?
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Another thing which I didn't read about but I want to talk about is just how you mentioned your merchandise and you know how the different ones you've had. There's a picture in the book of your very first
yeah.
yellow
oh my
shirt.
God.
Great. When did you guys, and you talk about it, about how important, you mentioned that Rami, who may or may not be El Generico, really.
Or Sami Zayn.
Yeah. Really took it seriously,
yeah.
the merchandising right off the bat. You guys obviously learned to do that too, because to this day, you're still one of the top selling merch people yeah. and reinvented the business as far as all the Hot Topics. And basically was one of the reasons why AEW was even created in the first place.
Yeah.
When did you guys start thinking and really get into the merchandise?
Probably when we finally started flying out to the East Coast, would you say?
Yeah.
Like, and seeing El Generico selling, like, and Colt Cabana.
And Chris Hero.
And Chris Hero, guys like that. We saw their meet and greet lines, and we're like, wait a minute. There's literally no one in our line. What are yeah. they doing that we
and
aren't?
What were they doing that you did?
They just knew how to connect with the audience. They were very inviting, and like, we were shy and we had our heads down.
They were interacting like it was almost yeah. like a flea market. Like,
and we were embarrassed to be there. So we had yes. our head down and we weren't looking, getting eye contact. And these guys were just like, come on down, come meet us and
right.
things like that. And we saw that. And we're like, I'm embarrassed to do that.
Yeah.
But look, they're making all the money and we aren't.
Well, and then they just had better designs.
That too.
And
for
they
sure.
were known wrestlers.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't.
Yeah, yeah,
nobody
yeah.
knew who the hell we were. And,
but they had a charisma about them.
Yeah.
And we were like, we need to start learning from these guys.
I remember we had a King of Trios weekend, and that was the big like trios tournament that Chikara would run. And that was like a really big learning lesson for us because we saw how big merch could be. Because we saw those were the only guys making any money on it. Like, they would come back with, you know, hundreds of dollars in cash, and yeah. we were lucky to sell one or two t-shirts.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the secret, though. They were like, our payday isn't much, yeah. but this is the payday, the t-shirt sales. And
yeah.
we're like, really? Okay.
And we did the weekend where it was like night one, we sold one shirt, two shirts. Then we had a really good match, though. So then night two, maybe we sold four or five shirts. But then we had a great match on night two. I think that's yeah. when we did this four-way famous match with Generico and Ibushi and Jigsaw.
Yeah.
So after that's when like we realized like our lines were getting a little bit bigger,
By night three, we sold out on the shirts that we brought. We're like, oh, my God.
Because people were impressed by your work.
That's what it hit me, though. I was like, oh, my God. Like, wrestling's kind of like the infomercial. Like, this is the actual product.
Good point.
You know what I mean? Like, we're out there. We're advertising what we are. We want people to get here to buy the actual product.
We took a lot from that weekend.
And we learned. We started marketing ourselves a little bit more. It wasn't just – we worried about the weird things, like stuff that didn't even matter. We're like, this is our livelihood.
But I was the same when I went to Smoky Mountain Wrestling. I mean, the idea was you had to go sell merch in intermission. And a lot of times I hated going to the merch table before my match because I come from the rock and roll mentality is that, you know, Mick Jagger's not at the merch stand before the Stones.
Exactly.
And he's never at the merch stand.
Right.
But then you'd see the Rock and Roll Express who are on after us.
Yeah.
Selling everything. They would buy bed sheets, rip them up into 20 strands, write R&R on them, and sell them as rock and roll headbands.
Wow. Brilliant.
And they were all about it. And Tracy some others too. And I just, like you said, I was embarrassed to be there. I never got that part of it. Thankfully, I was only there a short time and I never had to do it again, but I would have been the same as you guys.
Yeah. You're right though. Like, it's all about perception, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's weird to do it.
I hated the thought of that.
Yeah. And then, like, I don't know, somewhere along the lines, it became like charming to do it, and people look forward to it. With us, at least, it was part of our act.
And then we started learning these little tricks. We'd be like, "Hey, promoter, can you put us on right before intermission, and then after our match, we'll go right to the table.
We'll get on the mic and say, follow us to the table, baby."
Yeah. Yeah.
And we just had this killer match. Yeah. Everyone's like, "I want to meet these
guys."
See,
that's smart.
Yeah,
that's what. And that to me would make more sense because you've just worked Pied Piper to the merch stand, and you're still hot and sweaty, so you don't have to bother getting energy again.
But what worked for us was, like, we put it, it was part of our act. The merchandise thing was part of our act. So it's like, when we were out there, they're like, of course they're out there. This is what they do.
Right.
They're the Young Bucks,
our gimmick.
DIY merch guys. So we would be out there before the show, we'd be out there at intermission, and we'd be out there at the end.
Yeah.
And we would sell so many shirts.
Yeah, I remember it was so funny. We'd be wrestling like a tag team that was less experienced than us, and they'd be scared to death. They're like, when are they going to come and talk about this match?
Their match two would be on, and we're still out there hustling t-shirts.
But we were doing it so often.
And we're match four.
Which is funny, because it's the same thing you said that Rami did.
Yes.
Yeah.
When he was selling his merch.
And we were the nervous guys.
Yeah, we learned it from him. It's like, so
where
funny.
Where is he? Come on, Rami. We have a match, you know,
because now we understood it's a business, you know, like,
but like when you get that sharp and confident, it's because you're doing it so much. It's because you're doing 3 to 4 shows a week and you know your act. You could take that act every town and plug it in. Like, you don't have to overthink it. Like, it's so much different now, like being on TV every week where it's like every match is seen by a million people or whatever. And it has to, you have to micromanage every single thing. There, it was like, these 200 people will watch this, or 400 people will watch this match.
We do whatever we want.
Do whatever we want.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll meet all 400 of them probably.
Yeah.
We'll go to the next time. We'll do the same thing. So we just plugged in our act, and we got really sharp at that. We knew, and it was really intimate. So, like, they could hear everything we were saying. So we got really good at engagement.
Right.
Like, we would be in the ring, and we could literally have conversations with some of the fans, and they loved that. Like, wow, we're part of the show. Like, we started getting good at that character stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's truly when our merchandise started taking off. And when we implemented the merchandise thing as our act, they're like, the Bucks are coming to town. I can meet them. And it almost became like a campaign for us. Like, we were on a campaign trail. And we would show up and shake your hand and kiss your baby.
Mm-hmm.
You'd meet us. Yep. It was like this weird rite of passage. If you got a Young Bucks shirt, you did it. Oh, you had the full Young Bucks experience? You took a selfie with him and you got a shirt? Like, it was part of our act.
A VIP package.
Yeah, right.
It was like, it was charming almost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm at the Bucks. Here's my proof of it. Here's my t-shirt. And that's what we did. And the merch thing blew up from that point.
As we start to wind down here, I don't know if you wrote about it in the book, but I'm just curious for my own self, was the Hot Topic deal.
Yeah.
Because when I was working in New Japan before AEW started, I got into Hot Topic too. Basically because of you guys and the buyer, and that was some good money for me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't selling half of what you guys were selling.
Yeah.
Especially that I had the Alpha Club or whatever that was.
Yep.
That one was huge.
Oh, that was everywhere.
They made little pins and patches. So how did that all come about?
Our shirts they got popular off of Pro Wrestling Tees, basically. That's where everybody picked them up. And
did Pro Wrestling Tees basically start at the same time as the rise of the Young Bucks? It seems like it kind of hand in hand.
We grew with them.
Yeah.
We were one of the first five wrestlers to open up a shop with Ryan Barkin at Pro Wrestling Tees.
And that's another great idea because he sells by demand.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to buy 144.
That's the secret.
Yeah.
And
all that was like Colt Cabana's brainchild, too.
Yeah, it was his idea.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and he got Ryan into all that.
That's when we got really good at making shirts.
Colt's a pioneer
with
all this
stuff. That's why his face is on all the boxes.
Right.
Gotcha.
Right.
I was wondering, how the hell is this guy on that?
We got really good at designing shirts at that point because we weren't afraid to try things because we're like, well, if it people hate it. They don't buy it. There's nothing in stock. There's no loss. So we started really experimenting with funny things and great ideas, designs that maybe I would print up 1,000 of them because maybe I'll get stuck with 999 of them. You know, so we got good at it. And anytime
we just kept selling.
Anytime we would say a thing or do a thing, we would have a shirt the next day. And there's you could never do that in the t-shirt business. It would take weeks to get a shirt.
Yeah.
And here it is. I would say something on a Saturday or have a viral video, and by Sunday I have a picture of a
and
new.
That's literally the truth. Yeah.
And that's what changed the business for us. And that's what got our shirts everywhere. And that's when I started going to the wild and seeing Young Buck shirts.
We started our YouTube show.
Yes.
And that helped a lot too, because we would promote our shirts on the YouTube show and say, hey, they're available now. Mm-hmm. And we would noticeably see like how many we would sell when we would release an episode on Being the Elite.
Gotcha.
And it was crazy.
Literally, I'd go, Nick, watch this.
Yeah.
We'd make the episode live and it's like ding, ding, ding. Yep. My phone's just going off. People are buying the shirt. It's like,
it was insane.
This is like an infomercial. Again, it was like another way of having an infomercial.
Yeah, but
for
now we had like a platform for everyone to see, not just at this indie where 400 would see us.
Right.
Yeah.
So that changed the game was YouTube. That helped tremendously.
And people started knowing who we were as human beings on the YouTube show, because we took them behind the curtain, let them meet our family members,
they could relate
our friends,
to us more.
The things we did, the struggles we had, how tired we were, and they started going, "Oh, this isn't just a couple of kids that like wear flashy clothes and tassels and they do cool moves. These are regular people. These guys, they're guys." And that's when our meet and greet lines started going crazy, even crazier, and our T-shirts were selling like nuts. And we're just like, "What is this?"
And it obviously helped that Bullet Club just went nuts.
Right.
Like everyone wanted the Bullet Club t-shirt. Yes. We were a part of that. And that blew up like
And you
crazy.
Know what Bullet Club? Bullet Club was like lightning in a bottle, because it was like you'd heard about it, but you didn't know quite what it was. You're like, there's this thing going down in Japan. And it felt underground and hip and cool. It was almost like a Fight Club thing.
And the logo was awesome.
Yeah. Yes.
And the logo was awesome.
And that always helps.
So when you have a sweet logo and you have all those things and people are talking about
it,
and there's
buzz, right.
But you don't know really what it is, and it's from Japan? Mm-hmm. Japan's just always cool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So like that shirt got really hot, so it made us hot in turn. Like we realized it, that Bullet Club blew us up. And there was a WrestleMania. What WrestleMania was it? It's in the book. I'd have to look.
Yeah.
There was a WrestleMania where we are at the peak of Young Buck popularity.
Dallas, maybe, or something.
Maybe. Bullet Club shirts are everywhere all weekend. And the buyers, it was Joe and Taffy.
Yeah, Joe, yeah.
Yeah, they were at the show, and all they saw was Bullet Club, Young Bucks, Kenny Omega.
And you know how WrestleMania is. It's a weekend of just events. Yeah. So they went to a bunch of the events, and they kept seeing
Young Bucks shirts.
Bullet Club t-shirts.
And they're just like blown away, and they're like, we have to get, these are the shirts we need in Hot Topic. Like, no offense to all these other shirts, this is what I've seen the most of. So they're like, they did some research, and they're like, where do we go? They found Ryan, and they're like,
well,
Ryan,
you can't leave this out. They contacted WWE. They said, we want the Young Bucks t-shirts and the Bullet Club t-shirts, and they go, they don't work for us. Go find someone
else. Steam shooting out of their ears.
Right.
So they get in touch with Ryan. Ryan tells them, hey, I work with these guys. And Ryan got with me. And I talked to Hot Topic. And they said, we would like to put some of your shirts in our stores.
We couldn't believe it.
And we were like,
wow.
It's huge.
We're like, absolutely. So we made a deal to get Young Buck stuff in. And Ryan, worked with New Japan. He got a licensing deal to get the Bullet Club stuff in. So they wanted to, first they were just going to start with Bullet Club and Young Buck stuff. And they were going to try it in a couple of the shops. It wasn't many.
Just to see how it would, do.
Yeah, just to see what it would be like. And at the 11th hour, they decided, you know what? We're going to throw Kenny's in there too, because like we want the three. So we started with the three. And I don't remember the exact number of stores, but they put them out. And it was they said they'd never seen anything like it. They were sold out immediately. So within, I want to say it was 24 hours, Hot Topic already reached out to me, and they're like, we're going to every store in North America.
We couldn't believe it.
And we were like,
because
oh my God.
You have to think, this is the store we go to as children, buying WWE t-shirts all the time, because that was the place to go.
Yeah.
At like every mall.
I think we went to a Hot Topic to buy those purple bandanas we wore as Generation Me at TNA.
We did. and our pants. Yeah.
It all goes full circle, you know.
Well, that was the place. Yeah, you go there, go buy rock shirts there or whatever. Yep. Yeah,
and that's what changed the game. It was like, oh, you guys have you have merch in a retail shop. Like, this is big time.
Mainstream.
That changed everything.
People
for
who
us.
Probably didn't know who we were still are buying our shirts now because they're selling out, and it just made us. It made people go, these guys are legit. And it was another one of those moments where we were like, the first time we got a crisp $100 bill, where we said, I think we made it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because someone asked us that the other day. When did you make it? It's like, it's a series of events.
There's levels.
Levels. Yeah. And it's like, for us, it's like lately, it was like, oh my God, I've always wanted an action figure.
Yeah.
Check. Oh my God, we made it. You know, I still haven't seen one on the shelf.
I want to buy my first house. Yeah. Boom.
Made it. I want to be able to
quit her job.
I'm going to say the same thing.
Like, things like that.
Yeah. It's like several moments where it's like, you finally get to a point where you're like, I think we've made it for years. You know what I mean? Like, when do you really know you truly made it? The book. Another thing I've always wanted to do since I read Have a Nice Day when I was freshman year in Miss Mirror's class in language arts, and it was on the shelf. I remember thinking to myself, like, one day I want to write a
book. But you constantly push yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be.
Yes.
That's why you're never happy. You're happy, but you always
want
more.
You're never content.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And you tell yourself that. You're like, once I make this much money, or I make it to this point, I'm truly going to be happy and I'll be fine. It's like, no, it's not true, because you're going to get there and you're going to have bigger problems.
That's it, yeah.
And you're going to want to do more.
Gene Simmons told me that. He goes, I always want to do more. Yeah. Wow. You know, Gene Simmons, it doesn't matter.
It never stops.
There's more to do. That's
when you're crazy. Truly driven, you just keep going.
Yeah.
And it's kind of sucks in a way.
And we see it with you. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy to see, like, you've done everything.
Yep.
Right.
You got your own band. You know, you have a podcast that's very successful. Yeah. You're still such a great wrestler. And it's like, we see that and we go, you know what? We could be like that too. Let's just keep driving ourselves.
Yes.
And you could get more success if you keep working at
it. Do you ever get to a point like where you're just like, okay, I'm cool. I just want to chill out and enjoy
it? Some days I am, but like, but there's always more challenges and things around the corner. You know, like that's what I love about working here is that this really is our company.
Right.
And if we don't, like we talked yesterday about writing some stuff, if we don't write the stuff, no one's coming up. Like in WWE, people were angry. What am I doing this week? Oh, shit. But it was done for you.
Correct.
Nothing is done for us here because we're in charge, essentially.
So if you fail, you're failing because of yourself.
That's right. And if you don't come up with, it's like you say with your book, you wrote your book because it's your voice.
Correct.
If I don't come up with more ideas for shit for me to do, I got nothing to do.
So it makes it fun then, I guess.
It does. Yeah. It's challenging.
You need a challenge.
Yes.
At this point, you do
have to have balance, though.
Yes.
You really do. And that's like,
that's what I struggle with.
Me too.
I struggle big time.
I get in trouble all the time at home for like, you work too much at home.
Sure.
Like, when you're working, work. But you're at home.
Yeah.
Don't just sit in the office and do shit.
It's hard because you're so used to go, right? And then this pandemic, especially.
It's the same for us.
Stay home.
All three of us.
Like, what? Yeah. I got to stay home and do nothing?
Yes.
So my whole life is on the road or doing something.
Yeah. And there was the whole month where you guys were home.
home.
That must have drove you even more crazy.
Right. At first you go, you know what? This ain't going to be so bad. And I've needed time off by day three because we're artists and we're creative and we want to do something. It's like, I'm driving my family crazy.
Yeah.
My kids are like, Dad, leave me alone.
Get out of here.
Like, and you know what? The silver lining in this is I've missed so many birthdays, holidays in my 16, 17 year career.
Yeah, we've talked about this.
It has been so wonderful. I've bonded with my family more than I've ever bonded with them ever before. I'm so close to them right now.
Yeah.
It's been amazing.
It's almost like there's going to be separation anxiety.
Every time I leave again. I leave, even for this, my kids are like, how many sleeps, Dad? I'm like, it's only 3 sleeps.
I know. It used to be 30 sleeps.
Yeah, it used to be 5 weeks in Japan.
Yeah, I know, right?
Chill out.
We had this week when we did TV last week and then went to Vegas for a couple of days. And I was like, you're gone 3 days this week? I'm like, are you kidding me? It used to be 4 days, 5 days every week.
Every week.
And you know what's funny now? It's like, God, I don't know. Are we ever going to go back to the old days? Probably not. I don't know. Like, but I think about that. I'm like, man, am I going to be able to deal with that?
Well, I think for us too, just working here, I mean, it's funny when you think about this. We've been a company in a pandemic without people longer than we were a company
that
with people.
Blows my mind.
But at least we were always just doing once a week.
Right.
So we're still doing once a week. And I feel for you guys. Like you said, you got to take this schlep from Jacksonville to LA.
That's a lot.
Every
with a mask
freaking
on.
Week.
Yeah.
With a mask on. That's the worst too.
That's tough. That's tough.
I've done a couple of LA trips to this Vegas trip. That's 6-7 hours
it's
with
a long
the mask
time,
on.
Yeah.
Take your mask off, take some water. Sir, can you put your mask on? Can I have a sip?
Yeah.
And they only give you water.
Yeah, I know.
There's nothing.
Like, and then if you're traveling right now, there's nothing open. Like,
nothing,
we'll go to Atlanta
nothing.
And there's nothing.
Nothing.
I'm like, I can't even find coffee in Atlanta.
Yeah. And then you got to go from Atlanta to LA.
Yeah.
And like I said, if they're like, I'll buy something and take it with me, but there's nothing open.
Nothing.
You know,
it's
so
and then when we land, everything's closed. Yeah. So we're like, what do we do for dinner?
It's bizarro world right
really
now.
It really is.
Yeah. Back in the day, you're like, oh, there's going to be something open. No, not anymore. There's nothing open.
It's bad too. And I can tell you exactly the snack they give you. It doesn't matter if you're in first class, no class, if you're riding with the pets, they give you a bag of Cheez-Its, a bag of those cookies, and a bag of water.
Yeah.
A bottle of water. There you go, buddy.
Here's for 6 hours. Here you go.
But there you go, man.
Yeah.
Like, can't you just give me a sandwich wrapped in the same thing? Anything?
What a weird time.
I know, right?
Well, we're never going to forget this.
I know.
Never.
You know,
our kids are going to look back at this and just be like, oh my God, what happened to the world?
We're living history right now. Yeah.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's bizarre.
Last question for you guys, because we like I said, there's so much great stuff in the book, and it just can give me a shorter answer. What's your favorite story in the book? Is there one that stands out for you guys?
For me, like, it was really painful to go back at some of these terrible times we had to live. Where I don't know why this is my favorite, because maybe I knew we overcame it.
Right.
But I tell a story about how we knew we had to quit TNA because there was no money there, and we were basically starving ourselves. And if you didn't work, you didn't get paid with the contract we signed up for. It was terrible. And we go into great detail about the terrible contract that we signed. But I was pregnant with my first baby, me and Dana, and it was little Courtney, and she's on her way, and I'm making no money, and we have to quit this thing. We have to quit wrestling for TNA. And at the same time, I had a side job, which people didn't know about. I worked at a machine shop on the side while I'm on television every Thursday night. You know what I mean? And that business went under too, because we were in the middle of the recession.
Oh, no.
So it was just rock bottom for me. And I told Nick, we'd quit the company. We were connecting, I think it might have been in Atlanta, actually. And I was starved. So I went into a Popeye's chicken, and I went to buy a chicken sandwich for like $1.99. And my credit card got declined.
Oh.
And Nick was already waiting with his receipt because he was before me. And I called him over, and I was devastated, like having to ask my younger brother to buy me a $2 sandwich.
Eesh, yeah.
So he slid his card and bought it. And I didn't talk for that entire flight home. Like, I was just devastated. And I came home and I told Dana, I was like, I have to quit wrestling. I said, there's just no way to live. I'm 20 something years old. We have a baby on the way. I don't have a job. I'm unemployed now. Like, I have to quit wrestling. And Nick, you know, credit to him, he had faith that there was more, you know, to come for us. And he convinced me not to quit yet. And he's like, if we're going to do this, let's do this right. And let's wrestle the way we want to wrestle. And that's when we kind of did the attitude switch.
Right.
And started not caring and not obeying the weird wrestling rules that we all, you know, the unwritten rules that wrestlers have to do.
Yeah.
And once that,
you know what, sometimes you have to hit rock bottom
to get to that place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was our rock bottom moment. Yep. I think it was rough. Even after that, we continued to fail. We had a failed run at ROH.
Continued to fail.
It was bad for a long time. And going back and writing about this, it was hard. I had to put my brain back in that year, and like, I was crying writing this stuff, and it was devastating. And even though I knew there was a good part coming out of this, like, it was hard to go back to that point where like, I would have to look out of my window every morning when I'm making coffee to see if my truck got repossessed or like waiting for the note to show up that we're getting evicted out of my apartment. Right. Like, it was that bad, really bad for a while. It got to the point where like, I couldn't even ask my in-laws like to borrow money anymore from them. I just couldn't do it. Like, I'd borrowed so much from them. I was so in debt. I had $10,000 in debt on credit cards. Like, it was bad. And just like relive like the stories of us overcoming that and climbing that slow climb back to success. Like, that for me feels so good for me. Like, and now I know how the ending is. Like, it's a happy, happy ending. So like, that made me feel good. But the struggle is so real. And I hope now it's a terrible time. 2020 sucks. And everybody's dealing with hardships and terrible stuff. I think people can read this story, even if they're not a wrestler, a wrestling fan, or just anything. They can take some inspiration out of it. They could see that, hey, I'm having a hard time this year. These guys overcame this. Maybe there's hope for me.
Right.
Because we were just two poor kids from Southern California, average-sized guys, you know, trying to make it in the land of giants at the time in the early 2000s. Yeah. We had to be 250 pounds.
Yeah.
And, you know, 6'3 or whatever. And we weren't those guys. And somehow we made it out. And here we are. And I hope people could read that and they could, you know, maybe have a little bit of hope right now in this really dark time called 2020.
Yeah. And they don't even have to be wrestlers to get that take from it. You know, it could inspire anyone.
No, you're right. Yeah.
In any field of business, you know.
Right.
Yeah. You're exactly right. Is there a tale that you like in there?
Yeah. You know what? I'll try to make it a little shorter. I think, in a sense, just to try to be nice to everyone. And little did we know, being friends with Okada in 2009 and TNA and having his back would actually help us get our biggest break of our career 4 years later.
Wow, I didn't know.
And
that.
He would actually call us and say, hey, I'm a big thing now here. You guys want to come over to Japan? because we're friends, you know? And here you are. Here's a job, pretty much. Yeah. And, you know, that would probably be my cool take from it is you never know
Dude, you never
know. Who's going to help you later on in life?
I bought Giotto and Gato a hot dog in Mexico City in 1993 because they didn't have any money.
Yeah.
I took them out for lunch. They got hot dogs. I'm like, hot dogs? You can have the Salisbury steak if you want.
Right.
And here they are, Gato, you know, same thing as you.
New Japan.
25 years later, I'm headlining the Tokyo Dome with him as the booker who got me over there. You just never know.
That's crazy.
Be nice to everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Treat everybody with respect. That's how we've always tried to be.
Yeah. So Ozzy says, treat everybody nice on the way up because you never know when you see them on the way down.
Yes, right. Sir. Yeah. It's true, though. Yep.
Guys, it's great talking to you always. And I'm excited to finish the rest of this book. And let's go make some money today.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us
Young
on.
Young bucks. Yeah, it's dollars.